Those forces represent a central pillar of the colonial order. They're really just servants to, you know, their imperialists or neocolonial masters. And so for that to change, there has to be some sort of serious class struggle on the African continent against these servants we call, you know, heads of state and their contemporaries, the compradors, the African ruling class. And I think without that class struggle, there won't be a major split at the COP27 summit. There'll only be minor statements of grievance, like we're seeing, you know, today with certain folks kind of speaking out.
Now, Ugandan President Yoweri Museveni has expressed readiness to work with other willing partners in the country's oil pipeline project after the European Union expressed opposition to the development of the country's oil resources. Let's take a listen.
East Africans, therefore, should not worry about those arrogant people, that those arrogant people can stop the oil project in East Africa. If any actor tries to delay our project, we shall decisively deal with that betrayal according to the relevant laws. We shall develop all the aspects of the project with willing partners. Initially, I was not interested in the pipeline. I was only interested in the refinery to produce petrol, diesel, aviation fuel for East African market. It is Total who insisted, even when Uganda had to give away $20.7 per barrel to use the pipeline. In the end, we support the pipeline because it contributes something modest to our Tanzanian sisters and brothers who, under Mwalimu's leadership, contributed so much to Africa, including Uganda, in the anti-colonialism effort. Besides, the pipeline corridor provided by the Tanzanian government will bring to us gas from Tanzania and Mozambique because our gas resources are not that big. We need gas for fertilizer manufacture, to produce chemicals, etc. Therefore, down with the imperialist parasitic meddlers.
Now, what option do African countries have if Western oil multinationals and financial institutions withdraw from fossil energy projects in Africa?
Western oil multinationals and, you know, international or Western financial institutions are largely responsible for the current climate catastrophe that Africa and much of the colonized world is experiencing. What African countries need is debt cancellation. They need debt cancellation and reparations for the decades, even, you know, centuries of work that these institutions and corporations have done to impoverish African people and intensify that climate catastrophe that they're facing at this moment on the African continent and really throughout the world.
Well, there you have it. Western colonial powers actually owe African countries billions of dollars for crimes they committed against African people over the past centuries. This is the money that Africa needs to develop and attain self-sufficiency. I'd like to thank our guest today, Tunde Osazua, for his incisive analysis. And that brings us to the end of this week's edition of Africa Today. Goodbye for now.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
Recently, French President Emmanuel Macron has expressed his dissatisfaction with the US on multiple occasions. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites for further details. Stay tuned for more. The website of Global Times wrote, earlier this month, Macron criticized the US for selling energy and gas to Europe at four times the price the US sells to its own industry. Macron said, that is not exactly the meaning of friendship. He then reminded US President Joe Biden to speak with prudence when commenting on the risk of nuclear conflict. During a press conference following the just-concluded EU summit in Brussels, Macron again called out U.S. double standards over selling gas to Europe at prices 3 to 4 times higher than it is sold in U.S. domestic markets. TFI Global, an India-based media outlet, published an article on October 18th entitled, Forget U.S.-Russia, a Cold War is underway between France and the U.S., while the West is trying hard to portray its unity amid the Russia-Ukraine crisis, France is apparently not safeguarding the US prestige. This exposes deep contradictions in the transatlantic relationship. On the one hand, the practical interests of Europe and the US are in growing conflict. Due to the Russia-Ukraine crisis, global energy prices are rising sharply. Costly energy imports have pushed the eurozone into growing trade deficit. Worse, the U.S. Federal Reserve continues to raise interest rates, bringing huge pressure to the European Central Bank when it comes to policy adjustment. The euro has fallen below parity with the dollar, dividing to its lowest level in 20 years and ending a 1-to-1 exchange rate with the U.S. currency. On the other hand, the strategic goals of the EU and the US are not the same. The US is ganging up with its allies to safeguard its hegemony. This is not the ambition of the EU. The latter wishes to shape its foreign policy based on its own interest, rather than being forced to take sides in major power competition. This is the main driving force for Macron to stress Europe's strategic autonomy time and again. However, as the Ukraine conflict drags on, Europe is propelled to increase its reliance on the US-led NATO and has to sacrifice its economic interests in exchange for security guarantees. Europe seems to have no alternative but to allow the US to continuously impose the cost of Ukraine-Russia crisis unto itself, and its own strategic autonomy has been greatly jeopardized. In particular, the U.S. is relentlessly provoking the escalation of the Ukraine crisis, which has not only weakened Russia, but also strengthened the U.S. control over Europe. This has put Europe in greater economic difficulties, as well as on the brink of a more dangerous war. Behind Macron's warning to the U.S., there are not only great worries about the intensification of future crises, but also helplessness that he cannot control the destiny of France, as well as a strong call for Europe to strengthen unity. Of course, France has its own reasons for playing the role as an anti-U.S. fighter. France has a tradition of great power autonomy. It always has a global perspective, the importance of which cannot be overlooked. Former French President Charles de Gaulle had advocated France should adhere to an independent foreign policy and should not be completely constrained by the Western camp led by the U.S. For this reason, France once decided to withdraw from NATO's integrated military command, and it became the first Western major power to establish diplomatic relations with the People's Republic of China. Moreover, France has been an advocate for European integration. The rise of Germany's strengths, as well as the European debt crisis, once gave Germany the chance to lead Europe. After former German Chancellor Angela Merkel left politics, it gave France the opportunity to try to dominate European internal and foreign policies. In addition, Macron has his own political needs to take care of. Macron has regarded the revival of France as his own responsibility, promoting reforms internally and striving for France's status as a great power externally. In this year's presidential election, he was re-elected, but failed to gain an absolute advantage in the parliament. The domestic reform agenda was limited by the obstruction of the opposition. Therefore, Macron needs to make some breakthroughs in European integration and other diplomatic issues in order to strengthen his rule. The contradiction between France and the U.S., or between Europe and the U.S., is more of a contradiction in the Western camp and the result of uneven distribution of power and interest. However, France's disappointment toward the U.S. has a limited impact. It will not change the dominant subordinate structure between the U.S. and Europe, nor will it deal a fundamental blow to the hegemonic system of the U.S. It is impossible for France to give up the institutional dividends of the West either. But Macron's dissatisfaction toward the U.S. will more or less bring some variables to transatlantic relations. For example, when the U.S.-EU Trade Technology Council TTC meeting is held in September, the two sides will find it more difficult to coordinate with each other. In addition, when Europe and the U.S. have a trade conflict in the field of electric vehicles, Germany will definitely stand on the side of France. It means the deepening differences between France and Germany will be breached, and Europe will form a tougher stance towards the U.S. The issues that seem to be problems only between the U.S. and Europe could also add uncertainties to the current increasingly complex relationship among more major powers. According to Bloomberg, Macron said U.S. trade and energy policies has created a double standard, and Europe was left paying higher prices for its natural gas, according to a report by oilprice.com. The comments from Macron come following 2 weeks of protest staged by workers in French oil refineries Total Energies and ExxonMobil. France was the latest country to withdraw from the Energy Charter Treaty, ECT. It has now switched to being a net importer of energy from once being a net exporter of energy. There are strikes reported at EDF's nuclear reactors as well. Macron is unhappy with the price it is paying for the liquefied natural gas LNG France is importing from the US. It turned to the US for LNG to make up for its declining nuclear fleet and also for the total halt of the Russian energy supplies. Bloomberg added the oilprice.com report revealed that U.S. natural gas exports to France increased 421% during the first 8 months of 2022, but LNG prices are soaring and increased by 1,094% in August alone. In Brussels, Macron said that the North American economy is making choices for the sake of attractiveness, which creates a double standard. He pointed out that at home, the U.S. enjoys low energy prices, but exports energy at higher prices. He also pointed out that state aid for some sectors goes up to 80%, while state aid is prohibited under the Treaty on the Functioning of the EU, TFEU. Macron earlier this week referred to both the U.S. and Norway and said some nations are reaping the real super profits from geopolitical war on earned income. Macron's recent comments also reflect the troubles that are arising between France and the U.S. The ties are strained over the AUKUS deal, where the U.S., the U.K. and Australia formed a grouping, and the U.S. said it would provide Australia with 8 conventionally armed but nuclear-powered submarines. Australia earlier had a pact with France with respect to nuclear-powered submarines. Macron is expected to visit the United States in December and will take up the subject of energy with his American counterpart, Joe Biden.
At the start of World War II, both the Axis and Allied forces had poisonous shells. A total 50,965 tons of poisonous agents were deployed by both sides of the conflict, including chlorine, phosgene, and mustard gas. Official figures declare about 1.3 million casualties directly caused by chemical warfare agents during the course of the war. Yet the end of the war was not the end of chemical weapons. They were dumped into the dark and deadly depths of the oceans. I'm Zarin Shajeri, and this is Aperture. From 1917 to 1970, the armies of the world's greatest powers systematically dumped 1 million tons of chemical weapons into our oceans. A military secret so well kept that underwater dump sites remain hidden for several decades. This week's program investigates this untold story of global chemical pollution, which threatens our health, environment, and economy. These deadly poisons are leaking little by little into the sea, threatening fishermen, bathers, fish, and the entire ecosystem. Stay with us for the first part of the program.
I found a report that detailed the movement of chemical weapons from depots and storage areas in the United States in the 1940s, 1950s, and 1960s, that noted that some chemical weapons were disposed of at sea.
If you look at the lake, I mean, everybody's first response is, there's no munitions there. I can't see them. I see this beautiful lake. How can you have munitions? Reality, they're there. and we're paying a price for them.
Time bombs are ticking under the sea. 1 million tons of unused chemical weapons lie on seabeds all over the world, and their contents are leaking. This is an unknown story that cutting-edge science and newly declassified documents are now bringing to light.
Chemical weapons in various forms have a very ancient lineage, but their main military usage has derived from the First World War, where they're used in very substantial quantities. The first major gas attack of any significance was the use of chlorine gas during the First World War across a 6 kilometer front at the Second Battle of Ypres, launched on 22nd of April 1915. Other gases are introduced, but the big breakthrough is in 1917, when mustard gas is used for the first time, and it becomes known as the king of the war gases.
The new weapons attacked the body inside and out. First affected were the eyes with a severe burning sensation. Then there would be a painful swelling of the lids, followed quickly by blindness, sometimes permanent, caused by ocular clouding. The lungs were assaulted on a cellular level, prompting coughing, bleeding, blistering of tissue, resulting in respiratory distress, pulmonary edema, and death up to 10 days after exposure. The most noticeable effects were on the skin, where red lesions appeared before erupting into raised blisters filled with yellow liquid, severely painful to the touch.
The interwar period is a very strange period for chemical warfare. Most of the programs are secret, and the intelligence agencies know very little about the extent and depth and the innovations. And like intelligence agencies the world over, that when you don't know the truth, you assume the worst.
This is a new arsenal started at the beginning of a present emergency. It is now in production and can manufacture more mustard gas in one day than was manufactured by us in all of World War I.
The Americans acquire eventually something like 51 million chemical shells, or 1 million chemical bombs, 100,000 spray tanks ready for a chemical war. I mean, their production is colossal, 135,000 tons of gas.
The chemical war that everyone was expecting never took place. At the Potsdam Conference, the victorious Allies decided to split up the enemy's stocks and dump them in the seas. This was considered the safest alternative at the time, and they imposed official secrecy on this policy until 2008. Dumpings took place all over the world, in the Sea of Japan, the Indian Ocean, the Baltic Sea, the North Sea, the North Atlantic, and off the Côte d'Azur in France. Our investigation began in Italy with sea dumping in the Mediterranean. Those dumpings were unknown by the public until Gianluca Defoe, a reporter from Milan, broke the story in his best-selling book, Poisons of State. Documents uncovered by Defeo revealed never-before-known details of how chemical weapons from both sides in the war ended up in the sea. As far as the Italian weapons are concerned, on the Allied side, it was a daring air raid that brought their chemical weapons to the seas. On December 2nd, 1943, the German Luftwaffe bombed the port of Bari, and it unknowingly provoked the biggest chemical disaster in the Mediterranean. The Allies kept secret their chemical weapons shipment for fear of handing the Nazis a huge propaganda victory. This secrecy hindered efforts to effectively treat hundreds of Italian citizens affected when a cloud of sulfur mustard gas wafted over the city. We find a similar situation in the north of Europe and the Baltic Sea. During the Second World War, it was a theater of combat for the navies of Germany, Finland, and the Soviet Union. The Baltic is today, without doubt, considered the most polluted sea in the world. Cold War politics were a major obstacle to the scientific study of the effects of chemical munitions in the Baltic. With the fall of the USSR, Baltic states were now free to do the work. The Polish Academy of Science began ChemSea.
We are 11 institutions all around the Baltic Sea. Countries like Sweden, Finland, Germany, Lithuania and Poland. Now the Baltic Sea bottom become a resource. There are more and more pipelines, windmills, cables and so on being laid on the sea bottom. So it's not really safe to proceed without better knowledge. We are basically performing a risk assessment for the dumped munitions from the Second World War, which resides on the Baltic Sea bottom. And we are trying to assess the location of munition, the pollution of the bottom around it, and the impact it might have on the ecosystem. We are at the Bornholm Deep dump site. It's the biggest single dump site in the Baltic Sea. It's about 30,000 tons of munitions dumped here. They believed if we dump it in the Bornholm Deep, when we've got muddy sediments, it will not propagate to other areas of the Baltic because they thought it is totally inert area. No bottom currents, no water movement. It will stay where it is dumped. Nowadays, we know that the salt water which comes from the North Sea travels through this area and is moved to other areas of the Baltic. So if the sediments are contaminated, it can be a point source of contamination which is spreading to other areas in the Baltic. We decided to collect sediments very close to the objects, like half a meter if possible, and we can only do it with the robot, because with the robot we can take sediment samples which will be most probably contaminated with mustard gas or any other warfare agents. Sometimes you are seeing the encasements which are completely corroded and the actual agent sits on the bottom in lumps. It's leaking into the environment. We do not know the speed of leakage because some objects are completely intact and some of them are completely corroded. And it seems that sea is degrading it to more stable forms, but some of those more stable forms are equally toxic as original agents. Whereas the mustard gas decomposes to thiodeglycol, which can be hydrolyzed completely in the seawater to sulfur and carbon and hydrogen, so it's pretty much harmless substances. Whereas those compounds which were based on arsenic oil, they are decomposing to inorganic arsenic, finally. And arsenic is, of course, a poison. We launched like three expeditions now to the dumping sites, collecting fish, cod mainly. And what we have seen is the higher frequency of fish diseases and also some impact on the genotoxicity, because those compounds are highly mutagenic. So our partners from Lithuania were able to see the mutated blood cells. We didn't yet, at least, detect toxic levels of arsenic in tissue, whereas we've been able to detect the arsenic in urine of fish. So it seems that it's affecting the fish health, but actually not to the extent which makes it dangerous to consumption. There are many pollutants in the environment which can cause similar effects, like organic contaminants, heavy metals, and so on. So it seems that chemical munitions are maybe not a single factor, but a factor which enhances the environmental damage.
First of all, we are interested in that the fishing vessels and the fishing or the fishers are not getting injured by fishing that substances up. And therefore, we encourage them to, by having a regime here in the Danish area where we compensate them economically by paying, in fact, the same amount for the cost of the value of the fish they could sell on the market. Here we have the mustard gas in the middle of the fishes. That is something that has happened through the years, going from fluid to solid mustard gas. We have recent cases both in Denmark, but also elsewhere in the world, where you see that the fishing vessel, the people that are dealing with the chemical substances afterwards are contaminated and injured. So we still find subjects that contains both chemical substances but also the explosive.
Can you load in there?
We have a 24/7 365 response team ready to go out to sea and assist the fishing vessels that have caught chemical munitions. That is the unique part of the unit here in Bornholm. The last chemical report that we have was in March this year here, so it's a couple of months ago. That's the only one this year. So compared to in the 90s, where we had more or less between 50 and 100 cases per year, it has gone down.
In recent years, deep sea construction projects began in the Baltic Sea, and with them came fears that pollution could result with an accidental disturbance of the chemical arms. The Nord Stream gas pipeline had to be constructed around the dangerous zones because so far no European country has taken responsibility for cleaning up the chemical munitions in the sea. Americans who fought two world wars far from their own shores have now discovered a dangerous surprise close to home. United States officials now admit that thousands of tons of their own unused weapons were dumped by the military all around the U.S. coasts.
I was working on an investigation involving the local disposal of military munitions at the local bases when I saw photographs in the 1950s, the 1940s, and the 1960s, of barrels and barrels of mustard gas and Lewisite and phosgene loaded up on barges being towed to sea. There are photographs of barrels of mustard gas being thrown overboard. The military's records were very sketchy. They were scant. They were conclusive to a degree that they were quite sure that there were a number of dump sites, dozens of them, off of 11 different states in the United States, presumably off of some coasts of some other countries as well. That was an eye-opener. There are three chemical weapon dump sites the U.S. Army has identified to very vague degrees off the coast of Virginia. One of them is right off the coast of Virginia Beach here, where all these people are playing volleyball and laying in the sun. It is in very deep water, presumably around 12,000 feet or so. It's out near the continental shelf. That's where their records indicate this dump site was created back in the 1940s. They can't say with any degree of certitude if it actually is that far out. The reaction was one, I would say, of shock. It was shock within the U.S. population. It was shock within Congress. Congress had no idea this had been going on or that there were potential dangers off of their coastlines. That they were shocked that there was little in the way of active monitoring of these dump sites, or in the way, as far as they could tell, of any research being done to confirm their locations or to find other ones that the Army fully admitted that they expected to be out there. They just hadn't had any idea where they would be.
The Nord Stream project is setting new benchmarks. The dual pipeline, which is more than 1,200 kilometers long and runs through the Baltic Sea, links the energy markets of Western Europe and the huge natural gas reserves in Russia.
Baltic Sea fishermen face continuing threats that dangerous bombs or leaked substances will be caught in their nets. Bornholm Island, a Danish island, is in the middle of the Baltic, close to one of the largest dump sites.
I'm fifth generation fisherman on Bornholm. And we have manual, so we can how to deal with this. We have areas where there are dumped chemicals, weapons. The yellow one is a precautionary area, and the red is where we should be extra careful. And you have Bornholm here, you have the Baltic, Gotland in Sweden, and also an area, and a red area for extra precaution.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
The Limelight.
An exploded Israeli regime ordnance is scattered throughout the Gaza Strip, with at least 1,200 unexploded bombs reportedly found in 2021 in Gaza. These bombs have disabled a part of the population of Gaza and has deteriorated their living condition in the blockaded Gaza Strip. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites for further details. Stay tuned for more. The Electronic Intifada wrote, Kefah al-Zibda family has a 200-square-meter plot of agricultural land near Absan al-Kibra, a town in Gaza. In 2006, while tending to a crop of vegetables, which he sells at a local market, al-Zibda spotted a round metal object covered in something like copper, sitting atop the soil. As soon as he touched it, it exploded. His cousin heard the explosion and called an ambulance. Unexploded Zionist regime ordnance is scattered throughout the Gaza Strip, with at least 1,200 unexploded bombs reportedly found in 2021 in Gaza. Al-Zibda was 18 at the time of his injury. He is now 34 and partially paralyzed. And while he was lucky to survive the explosion, he has spent the past 16 years negotiating life as a person with a disability in the Gaza Strip. He has found that the already extant difficulties of life in Gaza are compounded for himself and others who have a disability. Al-Zibda has both struggled to access resources that would make his life easier and to receive medical treatment that would improve his condition. Between 2008 and 2021, he applied 13 times for a travel permit to the West Bank, and the Zionist regime has rejected every single one of those requests. In 2008, 2 years after his injury, doctors in Gaza told Al-Zibda that his knees were calcifying and that the arteries to his legs were obstructed. He prepared to travel to Nablus for knee surgery, but the Zionist regime refused his permit to travel. He said, "Finally, I had no other choice but to go to Egypt, where I had surgery on my knees, but unfortunately it failed." In 2016, he traveled again to Egypt for another knee surgery, but it also failed, producing no improvement in his condition. Mahmoud Abu Kamal, deputy manager of the Palestinian General Union of People with Disability, agrees that life for people with a disability in Gaza is trying, whether it's traveling outside of Gaza to receive medical treatment or accessing resources like an air mattress. He added, "Some people with disabilities don't feel they belong to society due to marginalization and challenges they face." After Al-Zibda's initial injury in 2006, doctors advise him to use an air mattress to avoid bed sores, yet even this has proved difficult. He said, "Although the air mattress helps me, the electricity outage for 8 to 16 hours daily exacerbates my suffering, as I have had bed sores for over a decade. It takes my air mattress 30 minutes to charge and the same period to collapse after the electricity is cut. He has no alternate source of power for when the electricity goes out in Gaza, so he is also unable to charge the battery of his scooter, which requires 10 hours of charging to go 20 miles. When the electricity is cut off, I can't get out of the house if the scooter is not charged," he said. "Even when his scooter is charged, the unpaved streets make mobility difficult." Abu Kamal noted that accessibility is an ongoing issue in the Gaza Strip. Abu Kamal said, "We discussed the adaptation of public buildings millions of times with officials, who always reply that these buildings are old and we can't afford to build new ones. If we get financial aid, we will build new accessible buildings. I had to crawl the stairs all the way up." Yusuf Abu Odeh, 37, has struggled with accessibility issues in Gaza's buildings and on its streets for years. Abu Odeh, along with three of his sisters, has cerebral palsy and requires a scooter to leave his home. In 2021, when his scooter broke, he tried to have it fixed but was told that the replacement parts would be even more expensive than just purchasing a new scooter. He requested a new scooter from Gaza's Social Development Ministry, but his request has not been fulfilled. Since the cost of a new scooter can run from $2,000 to $3,500 in Gaza, which is too expensive for many people who depend on social welfare, Shaksa applied to many non-profit societies to get a replacement, he said. "All of them told me they hadn't received funds, but if I had connections, their answer would change. I appeal to the international community to help marginalized people with disabilities in Gaza who don't belong to any political party. We suffer a lot from this situation that the Zionist regime has imposed on us." In May 2021, during a major Israeli regime attack on Gaza, Kefah al-Zebda was sitting in his house when shrapnel came flying through his windows. He lost two of his fingers as a result, he said. "When I called the ambulance, paramedics asked me to walk to the street due to our dangerous, unpaved street. I had to crawl for 200 meters while bleeding. Medical treatment became an even more pressing need for al-Zebda after this incident. In 2022, he sought the help of Al-Mizan, a Gaza-based human rights group. Al-Mizan petitioned the Israeli regime high court, which permitted his travel to Nablus for treatment on July 10th this year. Al-Zebda's surgery was successful, yet when he applied for a permit for his wife to accompany him during an October surgery, the Zionist regime rejected this permit. He still has not had his follow-up surgery. Samir Al-Manama, a senior lawyer at Al-Mizan, described the Israeli regime restrictions on travel permits for medical treatment as inhumane. He said, "This is an abusive, arbitrary way of treating people with disabilities. Kefah al-Zebda was prevented from travel for no clear reasons." According to the Middle East Eye, Human Rights Watch issued a report in 2020 that said a decade of Israeli regime restrictions have robbed people with disabilities in Gaza of their freedom of movement, as well as access to the devices, electricity, and technology they need to communicate or leave their homes. 3% of the 2.17 million Palestinians in Gaza have disabilities, according to the Palestinian Central Bureau of Statistics. The quality of spare parts for electric wheelchairs and mobility scooters is poor. They are not always available, and their prices are high, said Ali Al-Hendi, the owner of a workshop for electric wheelchairs. Al-Hendi said, "The motherboard price is 1,500 shekels, $432, compared to 600 shekels in 2012. The average price of a charger is 800 shekels, $231, up from $100 in 2012. I tried to import second-hand electric wheelchairs and mobility scooters last year from the occupied territories, which banned me from doing so. The prices have tripled and quadrupled because of the Israeli siege. 10 years ago, I used to carry out 2 or 3 projects a month for local societies to maintain electric wheelchairs and scooters. Now, I do one every 2 or 3 months. According to the 4th Geneva Convention, denying disabled people access to hospitals in the West Bank and banning medical equipment could constitute war crimes, said Salah Abdul Ati, a human rights expert and director of the International Commission to Support Palestinian People's Rights.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints
همه با وجود قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
Faith based on understanding. Saturday, the 4th of Ramadan, 1394, 21st of September, 1974. But I want you to know that when I talk about the generation that is losing its faith, I am not talking about the younger generation. I am talking about the generation before the youth of today, the older generation of our society. These who believe in some things blindly. Yes, they come to the majlis in the mosque to hear the sermons and storytelling. Yes, they come to the congregational prayers at the mosque. But because none of this is based on reason or logic, they can also be easily convinced to burn down the very same mosque, to trample Imam Hussein and to give up all their religiosity for those things they think have real value. They do this and you can see them do this. Today, one of the real crises that we are facing is in the generation before the youth, those who lack the awareness and understanding of the Muslim youth today and who sadly also lack the deep, unshakable faith of 2 generations past. They lack the thoughtfulness and understanding by virtue of which they could nurture a strong and abiding faith in themselves, and are instead held by the bonds of money, position, status, desire, prosperity, and comfort. Nor do they have a strong ark or impregnable fortress like 1 or 2 centuries ago in which, at the very least, they could shelter their faith, even if this was only acquired blindly.
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
A 100 years ago, these snares for one's thoughts, faith and beliefs did not exist. In those days, the hands of the enemy, those treacherous fingers, had not penetrated so deeply into the fabric of our society. There were still plots which had yet to come to fruition. They still had to deprive people of their fundamental religious faith if they wanted to heap misery on them. But these plots have since succeeded. The generation before the youth, the generation who are no longer young but are rather the youth of yesterday, they are trying to build their faith and belief in the face of a flood without even having a firm foundation on which to build. How lucky are those who chose their faith based on understanding, comprehension, awareness, and knowledge. A flood will sometimes carry off great trees while leaving those tender saplings unscathed because their roots go twice as deep into the grounds. Those things that have a foundation do not shake so easily. They do not fall so easily. In any case, this is a reality that is present in Islam. My brothers, the faith that has value is faith based on understanding, the faith that is joined with comprehension and awareness, faith based on insight, with open eyes, without fear of criticism.
You've done for me through all my years I've been lost. You guided me from all the ways that were wrong. Indeed, you gave me hope. Oh, Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done.
This is IRIB English Radio.
IRIB English Radio. With you every single moment.
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Rubashavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Poreza, London.
Rashan Saglam, Istanbul.
Sayed Amin Olemi, Kabul.
Shahana Bhatt, Indian administered Kashmir.
Around the world with reporters.
Lebanon and Israel have finalized a U.S. brokered deal aimed at resolving a maritime dispute. President Michel Aoun signed a letter on Thursday endorsing the agreement. The final paperwork was submitted to the United Nations in Naqoura, southern Lebanon, concluding a long path of indirect negotiations with the Israeli regime. Separately, the Israeli cabinet, led by Prime Minister Yair Lapid, also approved the agreement. The regime's representative then delivered the signed copy to the UN at the Naqoura point. Hezbollah Secretary General stressed in a brief statement that the deal is a victory for Lebanon's government, people, and resistance. Nasrallah also declared the end of Hezbollah's exceptional mobilization over the maritime dispute, saying the resistance movement had accomplished its mission regarding the issue. The Hezbollah leader said the agreement is not an international treaty.
What happened in Naqoura is not normalization with Israel. This deal is not an international treaty and is not a recognition of Israel. Israel itself has admitted it received no security guarantees.
U.S. Envoy Amos Hochstein, who was with the Lebanese delegation in the southern Lebanese town of Naqoura, had met the top Lebanese officials.
I truly believe and hope that this can be an economic turning point in Lebanon for a new era of investment and continued support to lift up the economy and make sure that whatever arrangements happen, they're done openly, transparently, and making sure that the benefits are felt directly by all the Lebanese.